I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
It reflects the sentiment of the American people who don't want their tax dollars propping up the abortion industry.
A huge win for the protection of the preborn after a major Supreme Court justice ruling is handed down.
This is a permanent increase that is indexed to inflation every year going forward.
Child tax credits, tax cuts, and defunding Planned Parenthood. The pro-life measures in the budget reconciliation bill.
Showing her we care more than Planned Parenthood.
And rallying the pro-life troops during National Celebrate Life Weekend.
South Carolinians would no longer be forced to fund radical activist organizations like Planned Parenthood.
States are free to block the abortion industry from Medicaid funding after a major Supreme Court decision. The case, Medina v. Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, centered around a patient's ability to sue to choose their doctors. The decision could have nationwide implications by allowing states to redirect taxpayer dollars away from abortion facilities like Planned Parenthood. Let's break this down. In 2018, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster's executive order blocked clinics that provided abortions from receiving Medicaid reimbursements. While federal funding is generally blocked from going towards abortions, McMaster argued that abortion clinics could use the money for other purposes. A patient alongside Planned Parenthood sued, saying that the order violated a provision in the Medicaid Act, which allows any patient eligible for Medicaid to seek health care from any qualified provider.
Well, it's up to the states to determine who is a qualified provider under Medicaid and who's eligible to receive reimbursement based on being a qualified provider.
The Supreme Court has ruled 6-3 that Medicaid beneficiaries do not have the right to sue to enforce the any qualified provider measure of the program. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster released a statement saying that the legality of my executive order prohibiting taxpayer dollars from being used to fund abortion providers like Planned Parenthood has been affirmed by the highest court in the land. John Bursch, senior counsel and vice president of appellate advocacy with the Alliance Defending Freedom, the firm that defended the state of South Carolina, joins us now to talk about this big win for life. John, the case centered on a beneficiary's right to sue. The justices found that while Medicaid law allows people to choose their own provider, that does not make it a right enforceable in court. The opinion written by Justice Neil Gorsuch said that to prove that a statute secures an enforceable right, a plaintiff must show that the law in question clearly and unambiguously uses rights-creating language. He determined that the provision in the Medicaid Act does not have that language. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, this is one of those cases where if you're not a lawyer, it may be hard to understand what the significance is. But what happened here is that South Carolina and more than a dozen other states about a decade ago all tried to defund Planned Parenthood as part of their state Medicaid program for a variety of reasons. And what the Planned Parenthood response was to recruit beneficiaries, women who had attended a Planned Parenthood for whatever reason or wanted to, who had Medicaid, and then brought federal lawsuits in federal court and demanded that they be reinstated. And there were sympathetic federal district court judges who were only too happy to put Planned Parenthood back on the payroll, and the majority of the Court of Appeals did the same. But the U.S. Supreme Court confirmed this week that they do not have the right to do that, and so that gives states the flexibility to be able to defund Planned Parenthood. And we know how important that is, because between 2018 and 2023, Planned Parenthood nationally, including all of its affiliates, received more than $3.2 billion in public funding. So if the states can stop paying Planned Parenthood through Medicaid, and then the federal government will stop paying Planned Parenthood if the legislative bill goes through on the budget, we're going to be able to close many, many of the Planned Parenthood clinics simply because they'll run out of money.
Do you think that there will be a push in Congress now to make language more specific when it comes to Medicaid coverage and rights? If so, how does that impact Planned Parenthood?
I don't think that there's going to be an amendment to this particular statute because polls show that the majority of Americans do not support taxpayer dollars going to Planned Parenthood. The U.S. Supreme Court was exactly right to say that there was no clear rights creating language in the statute, and so that beneficiaries did not have the right to sue. If a provider like Planned Parenthood wants to challenge a disqualification, they can do that through a state administrative appeal and then an appeal to the state courts. In South Carolina's case, Planned Parenthood blew the deadline, according to South Carolina, and so they may not have an opportunity to appeal even through that state system. But that's on them. That's not on the statute. That's not on Congress. People need to understand that when Planned Parenthood signed its contract to be a Medicaid provider in South Carolina, it agreed that its exclusive remedy was that state administrative appeal. And yet it just broke that promise and went straight to federal court so that it could try to get damages and attorney fee shifting against the state of South Carolina.
Are there other states with laws similar to those in South Carolina? And do you see them following suit?
There are many states that have already tried to disqualify disqualify Planned Parenthood and have been unable to do so because of these federal court injunctions. And I'm confident that many of them will go back and ask those injunctions to be lifted. There are innumerable reasons why states have defunded Planned Parenthood. In the case of South Carolina, they didn't want any public dollars going to an organization that provides abortion. In other states, they're concerned that Planned Parenthood is not only the largest abortion provider in the United States, but the second largest provider of dangerous experimental drugs for children who have gender dysphoria, like puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. Others are concerned about the deplorable conditions and the lack of health care that's being provided at Planned Parenthood's. And still others are concerned because of the controversy several years ago when it was revealed that Planned Parenthood was apparently selling and transferring fetal body parts and tissue. So you put all that together, there are many states that will want to do this. And now that the Supreme Court has cleared the path for that, I'm confident that many of them will.
And John, what does the ruling tell us about the direction the Supreme Court is heading when it comes to challenges like these, particularly those tied to state decisions on Medicaid funding?
Well, I think the court, as it has done over its history, is very deferential to states when it comes to funding decisions like this. As the court explains in its decision, a spending clause program like this is one where the federal government isn't enacting positive law, but instead is holding out money and saying, we want the states to administer this. And in a contract situation like that, you need to be crystal clear before you impose on states an obligation to defend lawsuits in federal court with attorney fee shifting if someone's unhappy about a disqualification. There have been more than 9,000 providers who have been disqualified all across the country. And if the Supreme Court had gone the other way, or if Congress had written a different statute, then every single one of those disqualified providers would be filing a federal lawsuit. But what that does is it takes time from the state attorney general's office, and even more importantly, it shifts money to attorney's fees and damages instead of to Medicaid beneficiaries, which is where Congress wanted the money to go. So I think this is part of a trend that we'll see continue of being deferential to states.
Well, John, thank you so much for coming on and explaining this so clearly to us.
My pleasure. God bless.
God bless. And now for more reactions, Ashley McGuire, senior fellow at the Catholic Association, joins us now to dive a little further into this case and its social implications. Ashley, you've spoken and written extensively about the cultural currents beneath our legal debates. What impact do you think this decision will have on the social and cultural level?
Well, I think one thing that stands out is the real continuity with this case, with the Dobbs decision, which is returning these very difficult questions back to the states, back to the people. And we know that people do not want their tax dollars funding abortion. And that was what South Carolina said. They said, we're not going to be sending American people's hardworking tax dollars to abortion clinics. Instead, we're going to redirect those funds to clinics that actually help women, that support women, that take care of their health, that give them a choice. And that's what people want. And that's what the Supreme Court upheld in that case. And I think it was a really important next step in this very sort of beginning moment of a post-Dobbs era.
Another instance in which we see taxpayer dollars going to issues that the American public doesn't want has been in transgender surgeries and puberty blocker medications. Do you see states moving in a similar vein to block tax dollars from funding these kinds of procedures?
Sure. And we had another important decision, Supreme Court decision. The state of Tennessee said, we're banning these procedures. They're harmful to minors. And again, people overwhelmingly oppose those sorts of procedures, and they certainly don't want their tax dollars going to those procedures. I think Planned Parenthood pivoted to that because their business model is imploding, because they're being exposed for what they really are, which is an abortion chain full of dirty clinics. I mean, I would point out the New York Times story that is horrific, talking about real abuses of women and children, dirty clinics. This is just not what people want on all fronts. So again, I think what we're seeing are the states stepping up to protect their women and their children and to say, no, we're going to take these tax dollars and we're going to direct them towards clinics that actually help women, support them, help them to thrive as mothers.
And actually, one of the arguments made in the case, and one that supporters of abortion make, is the claim that many women who seek other services besides abortion from abortion providers will suffer from a lack of medical care. What would you say to them?
I'd say that's a really tired narrative. I mean, we've known for decades that they don't do mammograms. This is not where women are going for their health care. This is where vulnerable women are being taken to by their pimps, by their boyfriends, and being exploited. This is not where they're going for health care. There are a plethora of options that are actual medical clinics that actually take care of women's health. And all these states are doing is saying, we're going to make sure that those Medicaid dollars, which, as we know, disproportionately are serving low-income women, are going to places where they're going to actually be cared for, not where they're going to be exploited and hurt.
And besides calling our lawmakers to voice our concerns, what else can we do to start changing the culture and just making our voices heard?
I think there's several things. I mean, I think one is pray. I mean, the pro-life movement was built. I mean, these victories have been built on decades and decades of prayer. So that's one of the most important things that everybody can do. But, you know, we also need to promote a culture of family. We know that the family, that a married woman is the least likely person to go seeking an abortion. And so we need to promote a culture of marriage. We need to promote a culture of authentic women's flourishing. I think we need to continue structuring our tax code in ways that support families to get married, stay married, and have children.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court handed President Trump a major win by limiting lower courts' ability to block his executive orders. Trump's order called for denying citizenship to the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants and temporary visitors. Justices didn't rule on Trump's order, but on the lower courts who had issued nationwide injunctions on the order. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that lower federal judges had overstepped their authority by imposing nationwide injunctions on the president's order. President Trump says the decision allows his administration's policies to move forward, including stopping federal taxpayers from paying for transgender surgeries. Turning to other major news impacting life this week, the budget reconciliation bill. As of the time of this taping, the House is reviewing the bill that narrowly passed the Senate yesterday. The vote was 50-50, and Vice President J.D. Vance cast the tie-breaking vote for the Senate. The bill has multiple pro-life measures in it, including tax cuts, a child tax credit, a Trump account for newborns, and school choice. It also aims to defund Planned Parenthood for at least a year. Lawmakers are rushing to meet the July 4th deadline to pass the bill. Leah Labresco-Sargent, senior policy analyst of the Niskanen Center, joins us now to talk about these pro-family measures in the budget reconciliation bill. Leah, this was a chaotic vote with things getting done at the ninth hour. Can you tell us, how did we get here and what is going on for families?
You know, I think there's some really good things for families on the tax side and some really hard things on the safety net side. And what really happened is this was a squeaker of a vote, and it's not clear what's going to happen in the House. And to get here, to get that last Senate vote from Senator Murkowski of Alaska, there needed to be specific buyouts for Alaska. And it kind of resulted in some pretty wacky policy no one would have designed from the get-go. So, for example, Alaska now has specific carve-outs from some of the food stamp cuts that other states are going to see. But they couldn't do an Alaska-only cut. That doesn't work. So they had to find a criteria that satisfied Alaska, but no, almost no one else. And now it means that technically we pay states a bonus to their food stamp bills if they have a high rate of improper payments, of paying out food stamps to people who don't earn them. This is pretty weird. They needed a solution, but I think we're going to find over the coming years there's a lot of weird compromises or kludges that have unexpected or undesired consequences.
Wow. Now, defunding Planned Parenthood is still in the bill. Can you share your first reaction, and is this a roadmap for future bills?
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood can no longer receive Medicaid payments. That means when they're doing a pap smear, when they're doing a blood test, anything like that, you know, the non-abortion services, those can no longer be covered by Medicaid. That takes a big bite out of what Planned Parenthood couldn't do. Planned Parenthood does a lot of fundraising, but that money is dedicated almost solely to advocacy at the national level, which many donors don't know. It doesn't help defray the cost of those normal medical procedures for patients who come in. So without Medicaid, it's likely that states, you know, even Planned Parenthood, some blue states may need to close or pare back services. And that's actually part of why it's only a one-year freeze. This scores as deficit increasing. And you might think, you're not paying money from the federal government. How can that cost the government more? But it's an anticipated freezing money to Planned Parenthood will save babies' lives. Those babies, you know, need more care at birth and everything else. It scores as bad for the government on the fiscal side, but good on the life side, but that limits how long they can do it for in reconciliation.
Now, there was a big expansion to the child tax credit to keep up with inflation, which is great for families, but is it enough?
So this is one of the strongest family members measures in the bill. What the CTC expansion does is it both raises the amount that parents get for their kids from $2,000 to $2,200. That's not as far as I would have liked to see. It leaves families behind where they were in President Trump's first term, which would have required raising them all the way to $2,500. But what's really good is this is a permanent increase that is indexed to inflation every year going forward. Until now, every year, parents saw their child tax credit cut until Congress did another periodic top-up. This is a much more stable setting for parents who need the CTC to take care of their kids.
That's great. A measure will require those receiving Medicaid benefits to find employment. What is the reality of tracking employment on such a large scale?
This is one of the parts that's a lot messier. So a third of people on Medicaid are kids. They obviously can't work. Only about 3% of Medicaid recipients are out of work for the long term. But the bill is scoring work requirements as saving a lot of money. You can't save that much money by just pushing the people who aren't working off of Medicaid. What's happened at the state level when states have tried to do this is while you're pushing off that small 3% who aren't working, you wind up losing a lot of people who are compliant with the rule as written, but don't get over the paperwork hurdle. The state doesn't have a record of who's working week to week. So when you're adding these reporting requirements, it takes a lot more staffing to verify. And if you don't keep pace, then families who are doing everything right get kicked off the rolls. And what you can see from the scoring of this bill as a cost saver, it assumes compliant families and kids are going to get kicked off. There aren't enough savings in the bill unless you're actually kicking people off Medicaid who are fully compliant with the work requirements.
Leah, I think a lot of what our conversation has illuminated is that these laws aren't perfect. There's a lot of compromise going on, and there's going to, quite frankly, be a lot of cleanup that needs to be done. What are some things we should be looking for, or what are some avenues for hope for our viewers? And even what should they be doing to ensure that, justice is done?
You know, I think one thing to remember is there's been a lot of hesitation expressed at the Medicaid cuts by members of the Republican caucus. So it's delayed until 2026. That's not very long to stand up a verification program at the state level. But I think the question is, will that get delayed further? You know, when people are thinking about how this will look, is there a fail-safe for if this isn't getting spun up in a way that will actually work? Will it get pushed back? Will it get revised? Will there be more funding to make it work in reality? And in the meantime, you know, we've pushed that child tax credit up. But, you know, will it get a further boost next year? Will we get more of that money as a refundable credit that goes to the families that are doing everything right, but just don't owe enough income tax to fully benefit for their kids? That remains to be seen, but there's certainly an appetite for it in some parts of the caucus.
Great. Thank you so much, Leah, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Just today, Wisconsin Supreme Court's liberal majority struck down the state's abortion ban. The court... Just today, Just today, Wisconsin Supreme Court's liberal majority struck down the state's abortion ban. The court ruled 4-3 that the more than 100-year-old pro-life law was superseded by a new law that permits abortions up until the viability of the baby. That is typically around 22 weeks. Coming up, rallying the pro-life troops for a continued action to protect life.
It has been incredibly fruitful. I have been able to learn a lot and really see the passion of pro-life leaders.
We take you to the National Mall, where an annual rally draws hundreds to be a voice for the voiceless. Stay tuned.
It's just a blessing to be a part of something that is so huge. Because we never know how God will use us.
Being the hands, feet, and voice of our Lord to protect life at all stages. The National Celebrate Life Weekend Diaper Drive and Rally brought together advocates for life right in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We were on the ground talking to those leading the rally and participants. They shared their challenges and hopes for the future. Take a look.
We are here to celebrate life.
It's so exciting. I'm so happy to be here.
Joy and excitement at the National Celebrate Life Rally. The annual event draws people from across the nation to hear from leaders in the movement and recharge among hundreds who share in their passion for this mission.
There's only one side that wins, and it's us.
National Celebrate Life Weekend is an opportunity for many to learn and grow in their advocacy.
We're coming so that we can get trained and well-informed to go to our campuses and to our parishes.
I'm so excited to bring the truth to people with a different message of heart and empowering women. We're in the Standing With You Fellowship, which equips unexpected mothers with pregnancy resource centers.
Let me get you some wipes, all right?
From students at universities to sidewalk advocates and lawmakers on Capitol Hill, the work is personal and can be very challenging.
Last year, when the Democratic National Committee was providing free abortions in Chicago, that did not sit well with us. We ended up raising almost $10,000.
Pro-abortionists target pro-lifers on all fronts.
If anyone begins shouting or anything like that or saying, God, I haven't seen too much, we just continue to pray peacefully, smile and keep praying, because those souls that harass us, they need prayers a lot. So we just keep our ground, be peaceful, be courageous, and be loving.
The reality of what is at stake is a message everyone promoting life is trying to get through to their neighbors, friends, family, and strangers.
I tell young men who are abortion-minded, it's not, I might be a dad or I'm going to be a dad. You're already a dad. The baby's already been created. And so let's figure out how to be the best dad possible.
Planned Parenthood admits to performing 402,230 abortions from 2023 to 2024, according to their latest annual report. Fighting for the preborn was, of course, the focus of today's rally. But as we know, there are many issues impacting the dignity of life, including the rise of gender ideology.
This ideology, the one claiming that gender is fluid and biology is irrelevant, has direct roots in the same worldview that fuels the abortion epidemic.
Keynote speaker at the rally, Riley Gaines, a 12-time All-American swimmer, competed and tied with a trans-identifying male swimmer in the NCAA championships. Gaines says her faith keeps her rooted in her mission.
It goes back to the first book. We have a God who created the male and female.
She says the fight is much more dear to her heart now that she is expecting a little girl.
It really is fighting for the next generation, so it makes it so much more personal. Right, it's not a matter of policy or politics. It is a matter of the world that my daughter is going to grow up in.
The church teaches that gender ideology does not align with medicine, natural law, and the truth that the human person, created male or female, is a gift from God and part of his intentional design.
We stand for women, we stand for children, and we stand for life.
We provide hope. We provide possibility just like God. We are God's, you know, hands and feet walking this walk for people who decide to say yes to life. And we say, yes, we're going to come alongside you and help you as much as we can.
on all fronts of the pro-life movement, was praised for the one who keeps them hopeful for creating a culture of life.
I would just encourage people to remember the power of prayer. So much of what we've seen is incredible, especially given if you look into the history of things, there's a new light and a new hope. It's incredible to see where God can take us.
Students for Life also held a diaper drive at the rally. They raised nearly 400,000 diapers from the pro-life diaper company Every Life. These essentials will be sent to churches, pregnancy help centers, women, and families in need.
This is not compassion, this is exploitation. Yet Americans are forced to fund this evil.
Thousands of pro-lifers participated in Defund Day, holding peaceful demonstrations outside of Planned Parenthood across the country. This demonstration, held outside of Planned Parenthood in Washington, D.C., featured Kimberly Byrd, a live-action speaker who called for prayer for abortion-minded women. The event, planned by Live Action, not only marked the 3-year anniversary of the Dobbs decision, but also called on Congress to withhold taxpayer dollars from Planned Parenthood, a provision in the new budget bill. Planned Parenthood received $800 million in taxpayer dollars, according to its last fiscal report. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.